This is Aiden here with Oddball Pilot.
And this is Mike.
We're here to speak with Doug Daugherty, who I flew with at Hagland Aviation, which is currently called Era Alaska, up in Alaska. When I first met Doug, he was based in Bethel, and I was in St. Mary's, and he was kind of the grizzled old Hagland bush pilot at the tender age of probably about 23 at that point. And I further went on to fly with him in Nome, where he was a station manager and also served as my training captain in the 402 and later the F-406. Doug is now featured prominently on the new Discovery Channel show Flying Wild Alaska, and Mike and I thought we'd give him a call and kind of talk about what it's like flying in Western Alaska, what it's like flying for Air Alaska, and what the differences are between what people may see on the television and what the reality of flying out in bush Alaska is. So let's start off with just a little background on Doug, and I think he's on the line here. Doug, you on?
Hello, Aiden. This is Doug.
Excellent. Welcome from Seattle to Anchorage. I'd like to just ask you a few quick questions just on how you got into flying and where you started flying and how you ended up in Alaska. You grew up in California, right? So you started flying down in California.
That is correct. I am from originally from Northern California, where I lived my entire life, learned how to fly up until the ripe age of 20 years old, when I moved to Alaska on a one-way ticket with hopes of a flying job.
Oh, wow. Yeah, see, this is the best thing about these interviews is that even people I know well, I started learning more and more as I go. I wasn't aware you didn't have a job when you came up. What flight time did you have when you arrived in Alaska, and what type of job were you thinking of getting when you showed up?
Well, when I landed in Anchorage, Alaska, I had 750 proud hours. And at that point in time, I knew I wanted to fly in Alaska because of the freedom of flying that I believed it represented, and I believe it still does. However, the specific type of flying job, I was not prejudiced of.
Okay. Did you have any contacts up there when you went up, or you just totally went in the blind?
I had one contact, which was the chief pilot of a prominent airline at that time, which has since gone out of business. And I was too low experience for him to really invite me up, but he said, if you get to Anchorage, give me a call. So I got to Anchorage, and I called his number, and I had learned that he no longer worked for that company.
That worked out pretty well for you.
It worked out fine. It was I did not have the support of my family, as you can imagine, since now being 40, looking back at a 20-year-old, I would think that they're just nuts to just go travel 3,000 miles without knowing anybody, without the promise of a job with a one-way ticket. But for me at the time, I knew I needed to go north to pursue, I guess, what is a dream. And I really have no regrets. I would do it exactly the same way if I was to do it over again.
Cool, excellent. And you started off, you did end up getting a job either in Bethel or Antioch first. I'm not sure which one you ended up at first.
You are correct. I got a job at St. Mary's first.
Okay, St. Mary's, okay. And that was with Mark Air.
Mark, yeah. What happened is when I got extremely lucky. When I called looking for that chief pilot at Mark Air Express, they said that he was no longer employed. And I was just real quiet because I had no other thoughts of what to do next. And then the secretary said, however, you must be here for the ground school. We'll go send somebody to the airport to pick you up. And, what was interesting is with my type of aviation training, I didn't even understand that a ground school was required for what I was applying for.
Got it.
I learned pumping fuel and washing and waxing airplanes, and I thought I completed my ground schools when I got my tickets. So I was pretty much in the passenger seat, but ended up securing a job, and so I got very lucky.
So you got the job right from there. They picked you up for ground school and said, well, we didn't hire you, but we might as well hire you now?
Actually, what happened was They ended up having a couple of no-shows, and they had us all in class, and they told us they were going to bring us out of class one at a time for interviews, and they had 24 people in class for 12 positions that were available, so they told us they were going to intentionally weed out half. And of all of the 24 pilots, I had the second lowest experience in the entire class, so I felt pretty insecure about my presence. And when I got called into the office for my interview, I had a resume in hand that they handed them, and I just spoke very candidly with the chief pilot and assistant chief pilot, and I think they understood I was probably in need of a little bit of help, but I was being so open and honest with them, I bet it was a little bit refreshing.
Yeah, it probably was. Cool. That's kind of a new side to that story to me. And yeah, I guess I do remember you ended up in St. Mary's. That was, what, like 91, 92?
That was April of 91, correct. I, out of the 24 pilots, I was the first one online making money, just the way circumstance had ended up. And I moved to Bush, Alaska full-time at that point, and I still reside full-time today. So never looked back, I guess.
Yeah, okay, yeah, you live out in Nome now. That's what you went from St. Mary's to Bethel then, and you switched companies, Cusco, and then over to Hagland Aviation.
Yes, I've lived in St. Mary's, I've lived in Antioch, Bethel, and Nome since 1996. And I did fly for American Express, and then I flew for Cusco Air under different ownership and Hagland Aviation.
Great. And then you ended up at Hagland. And just to clarify for listeners who haven't looked through our website too much, at some point in there, there's a spot with the history of Air Alaska, which used to be called Hagland. And so
yeah, the history of Air Alaska is
on.
Confusing for even some of our frequent flyers. Hagland Aviation is still my employer. They still exist. They are the country's largest 135 carrier.
But your official title when you're flying around now, you call yourself Aero Alaska.
We actually identify ourselves as Aero to the air traffic controllers, however, Aero Alaska to the passengers.
Okay.
And so,
it's confusing to me as well when I've been trying to figure out how to sum it up on the website.
It's confusing, but basically the owners of Hagland and Frontier decided to merge. But instead of merging the airline, they just developed a holding company. And then that holding company bought Aero Aviation, the airline. And then since then, they bought Arctic Circle Air. So what you have is you have a holding company, such as Alaska Air Group. Underneath that holding company, there are four smaller companies here in Alaska, just like Alaska Air Group owns Alaska Airlines and Horizon Air, two separate companies working under the same holding company.
Okay, that's the most concise description I've heard of it. That's great. What brought you, why did you end up at Hagland? You know, when you tried Mark Air, and then I think it was Cusco Aviation?
Yes, it was Cusco Aviation, and how I ended up
what
with Hagland is I became friends with one of the owners at the time, our good friend Tom Hawkins, and I was telling Tom how I had envisioned this great idea to start an airline in one of the villages, and I saw a need for a direct route from some of the villages to Bethel for travel. And I wasn't at the age where I really – I knew I didn't know how to put it together, but I knew I had the markets figured out. And at that time, I was offered a job from Hagland's because they wanted to open up a base in Antioch and sent me there to assist their station manager in opening their new base.
Okay.
That was in 93.
Okay. That's, when I showed up in 95, I went to UDAIR, and the Hagland guys were the guys who kind of really got the job done. And that was kind of, remember, we were pretty good at UDAIR too, I thought, in getting the job done. But down the street, you Hagland boys were generally a little bit more aggressive than we were.
Well, we enjoyed making fun of UDAIR.
What kind of planes were you flying back then?
Mike, thanks for asking. I was flying a 207 for Marker Express, Hagelins, and at Cusquare, I was flying a Cherokee 6. Back
cool,
in those days, I ended up flying quite a few different airplanes for Hagelins, but predominantly the Cessna 207 was the workhorse of choice at that time.
Yeah, you flew the 180 for a bit, and weren't you at, I think by the time they when I came to Hagelins, you were actually getting checked out, or they're looking at checking out on the Beech-18s they used to have.
That is correct. I was flying the 185 ski plane for Hagelins, and I was told I was due for a Beech-18 checkout. I never did actually enter into that because we ended up selling them.
Yeah, that's, I remember that was sad. I always wanted to fly those too.
I never flew a Beech-18, yeah, but I wanted to as well.
And how did you end up in Nome, where you've kind of settled into Nome pretty well?
Yeah, well, Nome has everything a small town in the lower 48 offers. When you walk into Nome, it looks just like you're in a small town in the Pacific Northwest somewhere. I had been living in villages and the town of Bethel, which is basically has the atmosphere of a very large or overgrown village. And Nome was very refreshing for me when I first saw it. Now, Hagelin Aviation did not have a base. I'm sorry, go ahead.
You had your first beer in a bar in Nome, correct?
Well, the correct term is Nome is the first place I've ever lived where I was legal to buy alcohol. I turned 21 in St. Mary's, a village where you're not allowed to drink, so that was pretty sober day for me, pun intended.
Yeah, I'm sure. All right, Clyde, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. I think you were saying there was no Hagelin base in Nome at the time. So.
Yeah, I apologize. We have I'm in Anchorage, Alaska right now for a recurrent annual ground school. And so because you're down south in the lower 48, we have a slight delay in the phone. That's why we're talking on top of each other sometimes. I apologize in advance.
No worries.
At any rate, just like I saw when we opened up the ANIAC base, in Nome, I identified an area of service that wasn't being offered. And so I presented an offer to Hagelins for me to open up a base for them in Nome. And they agreed. And so I opened up the Hagelin base in Nome in 1997 and managed it and also flew at the same time.
And that was worked out a lot with Ron Tweedo, Jim's brother.
Yep, that was Ron Tweedo, and he was very upfront, very nice. He told me exactly where I stood. He gave me a 402 to go work with and said, good luck. If it doesn't work out, you're out of a job. So I worked
yeah, I
very
kinda
hard.
I kind of bring up Ron deliberately because I don't think he's going to be mentioned on the Discovery Channel show, but Ron was Jim Tweedo's brother and one of the founders of what Hagelin Aviation is today, and he died in a plane crash in Arkansas, which was, I think, sad for all of us.
Everyone knows that Ron was the driver in the growth Hagelin Aviation experienced, and you are correct. Ron did die as a passenger in an airplane in Arkansas.
Yeah, which was a little surprising, but it does happen, unfortunately. Cool, yeah, I think I moved to Nome after you'd been managing it for about a year and kind of bringing it along just doing cargo, and then you started introducing passenger service for Hagelin and Nome with the – what we were doing with the 402s also, I think, before the 406 showed up.
Correct.
And
we had a 402 and a caravan.
That's right. We were living in your trailer.
And I recall training you in the 402 and our first flight. I had asked you to introduce a 500-foot-per-minute descent. And just prior to you arriving, I was training an individual that was having a very hard time with the aircraft. And I must have said something to you about how impressed that was that you were able to hold 500 feet per minute descent without much oscillation. And you were laughing at me that I was easy to impress.
You pretty much
you remember that?
Get your instrument rating. I do remember that. Yeah, I remember a few fun flights and doing some check rides later on where we failed about every instrument we could possibly think of to see what would happen.
That is correct. That is correct. That was, I think I gave you 13 failures on a check ride, and you got us in, so that was good stuff.
Yeah, that was pretty funny stuff. What's living like in Nome? We kind of were going to that, and I distracted you there. So what's the, what's the life like? I mean, you own a house now. You're no longer in the trailer. And, you know, kind of what do you do on your days off, and you know, what's it like?
Okay, so I have a handicap describing what it's like to live in Nome because I've lived here so long that I've probably forgotten some of the differences that someone else would notice immediately. However, I'll try my best for you. Nome has all the modern conveniences of the Lower 48. Now, when I say that, I'm completely wrong, according to everybody else who lives in Lower 48. we don't have a Nordstrom's. We don't have a shopping mall. We don't have a car wash. We don't have a Costco or a Sam's Club or anything like that. We don't have Walmart, Kmart. But what we do have is we have three grocery stores in Nome, and all those stores sell everything. They sell your food, which, by the way, a gallon of milk is about $12 a gallon. It is more expensive, perishables especially, because the time it takes them to travel to Nome, they're losing their value. But the grocery stores sell clothing. They sell propane. They sell, basically, if you go into one of our stores, it's a hardware store. It's a clothing store. It's a supermarket. They sell a little bit of everything. And because they're small and they're trying to sell everything, there's not a very big selection. So the joke that that my friends come to visit me to go on hunting trips in the fall, they have with me is, in Nome, you don't buy what you're looking for, you buy what they're selling.
Right.
Because if
but you can buy. I mean, as you're saying, it's a damp town. In other words, you can buy beer and alcohol. It's wet, excuse me, not damp. And that's a big difference between a lot of the villages out there. And
a lot of the villages are what they call local option. They vote, and they vote to not allow alcohol in their town. Nome is not a local option town, so Nome is what I would call a, quote, a normal town where you have a liquor store, you have a bar, etc.
Yep. And what do you do on like your time off?
What I love most about Nome is I live on the far side of town from the airport. So for me, my commute time is 6 minutes to get to work. And as you can tell, I'm being sarcastic about the far side, but it's true. And so if it takes me 6 minutes to get to work all the way through town, then obviously I'm on the other edge of town. And what's nice about that is I can leave straight from my house, straight out into the wilderness without any sort of a commute.
You have a cabin out at Cape Nome.
I do have a cabin. So if I want to get on my snowmobile, which we affectionately call snow machines up here in Alaska, if I want to get on my snow machine and take it for a ride, I just walk to my backyard, get on my snow machine, and I'm in the wilds of Alaska. I don't have to put it on a trailer. Same thing with my four-wheeler. I do have an inflatable jet boat that I actually have to trailer to a nearby river. But
and a Cessna 170.
I have 170 that I'm very fond of, and a small little cabin outside of town that I just love, because whenever my friends tell me they're going to the gym to work out, I just ask them, why don't you just go split wood instead, because you'll have something to show for all your hard work.
And you'll have wood for the winter.
And, of course, you know, I'll be happy to stack, you know, the results of their hard work for them to see inside my cabin so they can measure their success in their workout.
And you're also married. You married a woman that you met out in Nome.
I did.
Janet.
I married my beautiful wife, Janice, of 9.5 years now. And marriage, not age. Thank you. And we need to clarify these things. And she described our life perfectly about a year ago to a friend of hers. She said, my husband and I are addicted to the outdoors, and that describes it perfectly. That's why I love flying out here in Alaska, is because I'm outdoors, and that's what I love. And when I'm flying for work, I'm looking down, trying to look for spots I can go land the 170, spots to go boating, spots to go snow machining or my four-wheeler. And that's what I love to do. That's what makes me tick, is going out to somewhere to where at least I can act like, in my mind, no one else has been there before. And quite frankly, people may have been there at one point in time, but not on that particular layer of dirt that I'm staying on, since every spring the rivers flood and all the gravel gets turned over and washed away.
Well, I think I remember getting a message from you that you and Janice had gone out airplane camping in the winter, and it was like minus 40 out or something.
We landed at 15 below zero on skis, and it was 25 below zero the next day, which is really, really on the edge of limits of operating a carburetor aircraft, because the fuel doesn't atomize very well at those cold temperatures. And my wife had poured I poured it for her. Now she expects that, but she had poured half a glass of red wine in her plastic wine glass, and she swirled around the edge to look at the thickness of the wine, and it froze to the edges of the glass.
So it's good and thick.
So it was plenty thick. Correct.
Well, if I remember, Janice actually brought a daughter to your marriage as well, so you've got a stepdaughter, and she got into mushing a few years ago, which is another activity you all seem to be getting into.
Yes, that's correct. I have a beautiful stepdaughter at the age of 19, a college student, and she started off in grade school helping one of her teachers with her teacher's sled dogs, and decided at a certain point, why would I want to always feed somebody else's dogs when I can just do this on my own? So she started getting her own sled dogs and now has a team of 28 dogs. And since Christy is off in college, I get the great experience of taking care of them, which is fun. It's also time-consuming to take care of 28 dogs. It does take a lot of commitment, but it's fun for me because I'm real good friends with Lance Mackey. Lance, as everyone in the state of Alaska knows, has won the Iditarod, the Alaska sled dog race that goes from Anchorage to Nome. It's 1,049 miles. He's won the Iditarod the last four times in a row, which has never been done before. And
that's phenomenal.
When Lance gets to Nome, he stays with Janice and I at our house, and because of my experience at Lance, it allows me to probably get better enjoyment out of taking care of these dogs.
Yeah, the mushing always seems pretty cool to me. I know I've heard about it for years. I haven't seen you since you've been mushing, or I haven't seen you in Nome since you've had that many dogs, which I imagine are quite a handful.
Well, quite honestly, if I can be candid here, I started taking care of these dogs, flying sled dogs was one task that I disliked the most, if I can say that politely. Sled dogs they're not family house dogs. They don't get a bath three times a week like some people might wash their family pet. They're outside, so they stink. The mushers are taking care of their dogs, so the mushers stink. And so here you are in a small bush airplane, and your load is a smelly load, and the dogs, you know, they're not going to wait for the nearest outhouse to do their number. So you're flying this mess around, and it's cold. It's wintertime, obviously, or else they're not needing to travel anywhere if it's for a race. And so it's very ironic. The Doug Doherty of earlier years that would just absolutely not enjoy flying sled dogs to now I own my own team, is for all practical purposes at this point.
Right. Well, that's we've deviated a little bit from the purpose of the call, which is to talk about the TV show. I've watched a couple episodes. You know, usually it features, you know, certain flights where, you know, exciting events are happening. And I was up in Barrow when they were filming this summer, so I'm aware they weren't there during the sled dog season. It seems like they should have an episode Well, you've got to take a sled dog team around. I mean, that seems like
Oh,
a no-brainer.
actually, we did do some filming that involved sled dogs. And I can't speak as to what they're going to put on the show or not, since they have more footage than airtime. But Lance Mackey had chartered an aircraft, a Hagelin aircraft, to fly from Unicleet to Fairbanks so he could look at some different bloodlines of some different dogs to introduce to his team. And I took that charter, and the film crew actually rode along on my flight and filmed me and Lance together at the airport in Fairbanks, and we went to his house, and he took the dogs for a run and tried them out to see if he wanted to purchase one or more of those dogs for his team.
Oh, cool.
And like I say, I don't have any awareness of what's going to make the final cut, but there is footage for Flying Wild Alaska and Lance Mackey and sled dogs.
Okay, that's I remember some personal flights I did with sled dogs. I remember one flight in particular. I was flying in Bethel in the 402, and I got a call from Jim at some weird hour of the night, and Tim Sagunik's father in Shaktulik, he's run the Iditarod a bunch of times, but he was going to run the Cusco 300, and everything kept falling through and falling through, and finally Jim just said, get that 402 up here and pick up this team. The Cusco 300 starts tomorrow morning.
Oh,
and
God.
It was great.
Yeah, Palmer Sagunik is who you're speaking of, and he was definitely a local favorite.
Oh, he's a great guy. Sticking with the sort of the TV show theme, you know, we're all aware that it is, you know, reality TV, so they do tend to hype things up to make it sound more exciting. Like, you've seen the show, so you know the flight with like Luke and Brett. Do you feel like those type of flights are fairly common, that you fly hazardous material or that you're flying into a gold mine, and you think it's quite as eventful when you're doing it, or if it's more just like, this is work, this is what we do?
Well, okay, let me comment first on your first statement, Aiden, that they tend to hype things up. And I don't have any experience with any other type of reality TV, so I can't speak for any other program out there, but of the limited knowledge that I have of this one, I worked with the film crew for 3 months, and I've seen 2 episodes on TV already, and I don't believe that's an accurate or a fair statement to say they hype things up. What I do believe is occurring is because they have so much footage to choose from, they're obviously not going to choose the boring, mundane events. They're going to choose the more active events, and so when you take those active events and put them all together on 1 hour-long show, I think to someone like you and I that know of the many hours in the middle that nothing's happening, it might appear to be hyped, but it's just compact is probably a better word to use for it.
Right, they're picking and choosing the eventful events.
Eventful events.
Yeah, and in some sense, Doug, you could probably say that that's true of flying in general.
Yeah, you know, flying is not all excitement, and pilots always measure their experience and number of hours, which is extremely unfair to the pilots measuring their hours, because hours really shouldn't. Hours are just, that's just a number. It means nothing. Your actual experience comes from decision making, and decision making comes from events that are non-standard, or non-standard to you at that point in your career or experience. And so I think the more and more experience you have, the more boring it becomes, and that's probably good because that means that you're doing something right ahead of time.
Mm. You're still there. Do you feel like flying in Alaska, you get more of those non-standard events that lead you to get that greater experience in a fewer number of hours?
Yeah, the word fewer and greater means we're comparing this to something or somebody else, which
it's hard to do.
You know, I don't want to do, but what I can say is that there is definitely a lot of opportunity to find yourself in situations that require immediate decision-making and action flying up here. And I think sometimes the pilot can introduce more of those himself by maybe some previous bad decision-making.
Right. The other thing I I like about the show quite a bit is I think they get the feeling of Jim's family down really well, and the idea of what Jim is like to work with him as a boss. And I'm kind of interested if you feel that's fairly correct. I mean, none of us are going to say anything bad about Jim. Alien disease, you just can't do it. There's just nothing truly fine.
Right, not that I can't, but there's nothing to say bad about Jim. What really excites me about the Flying Wild Alaska show is they have done an exact job of showing you who Jim really is. What you see on TV for Jim Tweedle, that's really Jim Tweedle. And what you see on TV for Ariel Tweedle, that is really her. Inferno Tweedle, the same thing. There are two more daughters, Elaine and Ayla, and they have not been introduced in the show yet at this point. But I'm really excited that the reality TV series is not changing who these people really are. So that's really neat to see that unfold.
That's what I found too, and I haven't watched that much reality TV, but my impression's always been that they try to impose some preconceived ideas on the characters. And in this case, I'm with you. I think they're exactly who they are on TV and that they are in real life, which I think is pretty cool.
Well, actually, to expand on that a little bit, the Discovery is not the first network that wanted to do a reality series on either the airline, Air Alaska, or the Tweedle family. However, the previous networks wanted it to be scripted. And the Tweedles said, absolutely not. We're not going to do any scripting. We're not going to talk to you anymore. Just leave. We don't want to do this. And then finally, Discovery was presented with the offer to do the show as you now see it, and Discovery agreed no scripting. So even though the producer has a lot of footage they can put together to show a condensed version of a larger story, none of what you see is scripted.
Right. I think they won out with that. I think that's good. They're good material just as they are. I mean, they're just really genuinely nice, which is good.
One thing we've noticed watching the show, or I should say that I've noticed, is Era has a lot of planes in a lot of places, and they do a great job with the graphics, with the map showing what's going on in Barrow and what's going on in Unalakleet and all over the place. When you're flying for this company on a typical day, how aware are you of what's going on in other places other than what you're doing?
That's a very good question, Mike. The awareness of any one pilot or employee in this company is directly relative to how much participation he or she chooses. And what I mean by that is everything is very open should you ask. If I call Jim, the president of Hägglunds, and ask him any question at all, he's going to give me a straight answer. You ask the question to me, and me personally, I don't really choose to take the effort and time to see what everybody else is doing. And so my overall knowledge of any particular event is low because I'm out in Nome doing what I like to do, which is fly my flights and gauge my performance based on my interaction with my passengers and their satisfaction. And I don't get too involved in what somebody else is doing unless I get called for some support or some help. Frequently I'll get called for, since I've dealt with several situations over the years, it's been 20 years now, a lot of my friends will call me to give them advice on something, but unless something occurs out of the ordinary, like what you saw on the show, we saw Brett flying down to what they're calling 47 mile, I believe they're calling it on the show.
Yeah.
And I think we were calling it 47 Creek when I was flying out of Antioch, but what's really exciting for me is I had no idea that there was a mining operation there. I had no idea we were flying there, but that's where I shot my first caribou, was right there at 47 Creek. And I was laughing because they said the runway is at the base of a 4,000-foot mountain, and not knowing how to hunt caribou, I climbed that 4,000-foot mountain and shot one on the other side. I had not forgotten that. Never
yeah,
do that
I
again.
Know you, I know your favorite hunting practice is to look outside your tent, pick up your rifle, and shoot the nearest moose.
I have gotten much better at my hunting technique based upon that experience.
What's a typical day for work like for you? I mean, they don't really show that. They show people flying in Uniqlete, but like what, you know, you show up in the morning
that's
and
a very,
what
yeah,
goes
a
on?
That's a very good question. Easy to answer. Typical day for Doug Doherty in Nome is leave my house at 8:15 in the morning. I'm at work at 8:21. And to be specific, go to work in the morning, and I jump in either a caravan, a Cessna 406, or a Beach 1900. Those are the three airplanes I fly professionally, and I do one flight. Now, up here, a flight is not a flight segment. It's a round robin of multiple stops, and no matter where we're going, it seems like each flight lasts about 2.5 hours. So I'll fly from like a 9 a.m. departure. I'll be back at 11:30, and we can talk more about where I go and what I do when I'm out there in a few minutes. But basically, I'm airborne at 9. I'm back at 11:30. I get a nice long lunch break. I go home for a couple hours, and then I take back off again at 3 on the same similar type of schedule. And sometimes there's a later flight, so I'm either done at 5:30 or about 7 o'clock. And I do that 15 days in a row, and then I'm off for 15 days.
That's a pretty nice schedule.
It's really, really good if you live where you work. Some, or should I say, almost all of our pilots choose to live somewhere else. My co-pilot in the 1900 lives in Kona, Hawaii, and he commutes to Nome, Alaska to go to work every 2 weeks. Now, for those guys, they're not taking advantage of this nice long lunch break to be home with your family and your whatever projects you have going on. But they're taking advantage of being off 2 weeks in a row, which is really a fantastic schedule for anybody.
Yeah, I mean, I actually view it as like it's great if you don't live in Nome also, but you can go somewhere. You have jump seat privileges on major airlines, so you can get around the country for free, if I'm correct.
We have jump seat agreements with all sorts of airlines, and one of our pilots that lives in Barrow actually lives in Thailand, if you want to really get to the extreme.
Wow.
We have several pilots that live in Anchorage, and they commute out to the bush for their two-week shift. Down in the lower 48, we've got pilots that live in the lower 48, and they commute up, and they live their Alaska dream for 2 weeks, and they go back down to their, quote, normal lives, and their neighbors are probably wondering where they go and why these guys never have jobs and they come back, but it works for them.
When they're up there, are they living in shared housing, their own place?
You can always choose to have your own place, of course, at your own expense, but Hagelin offers free. I shouldn't say the word free. I take that back. There's a slight charge that they charge their pilots, but they have company housing available at all the outstations. And basically, it's what you would describe as a crash pad, and you're going to be hot bunking. So the room that you're in, when you're gone, someone else will be in that room.
Okay. That's what I did for years. I've actually thought it was all actually pretty good. The housing got better and better the more years I was there.
The whole company has matured over the last 10 to 15 years, and so the conditions are a lot more respectable.
Well, that actually brings me to another question. This is for my own curiosity as much as anything. I haven't been flying for Hagelin for about 3 years since the merger, and so I've seen changes occur. But what do you see as big changes since you started at Hagelin to where it is today?
The flying really hasn't changed. Flying is just that. It's flying. It's an airplane. It's a piece of equipment. You're an equipment operator. You're a pilot. You're going to make the aircraft do what you tell it to do, et cetera. What has changed in a big way is the amount of preparation pre- and post-flight to make this flight occur. There is basically what sums up to being paperwork. There's a lot of paperwork involved now that wasn't present 5, 10, 15, and not at all 20 years ago to make the same flight, go to the same spot, to haul the same thing. And
okay.
That because it's a different, you know, people don't like change as a general rule. And since I've seen the same flight take off, years prior without all this other requirements. For me, it's a frustration sometimes to have to go through all those same hoops to do something that I know was already done before.
Now, at the beginning of this call, Doug, you mentioned that you headed up there and stayed because of the freedom you enjoyed flying up there. And you said, as I recall, that freedom is still there. I'm wondering what you meant by that, especially in light of all the new paperwork and red tape and all of that.
There's still – okay, so now there's more preparation for the flight to occur. But the flight itself, when I'm flying for Hagelin Aviation – and I'm going from point A to point B, there's a lot of leniency that I'm given to complete that flight. Altitudes, routing, how heavy of a fuel load I choose to take, and how heavy of a actual pain load I choose to take. I have the ultimate authority on my flight to basically do anything in my judgment that I want. Now, with that comes, I'm going to have to answer for my judgment, and if I happen to be noticed by, let's say, the president of the company circling over a particular stream, let's say he's flying by and he sees me circling, he might say, "Hey, Doug, what are you doing?" I'll tell him, "I'm circling over a bear. My passengers here saw a bear, and I wanted to go back and take a better look." I just cost him $100 in gas, and he's not going to have a problem with that. That's called freedom.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty good. And well, you also get one thing I always like is if you look through your manifest and you realize it was all, you know, cattywampus, you call back on the radio and say, "Hey, listen, guys, it doesn't make sense for me to go, you know, White Mountain, Gullivan. I should go Gullivan, White Mountain." People are like, "Okay, well, that makes more sense. Then do it that way."
Exactly. If we see a better way of doing something, if anybody sees a better way of doing something, the company is always really eager to listen to the better way and do it that way.
Jim always sees a better way to do it whenever a plane gets within about 100 miles of Unicleat.
Yes, we always joke around about Jim because he dispatches from the air. He's out there flying a lot, and so when we take off out of Nome, Nome's 130 miles to the west of Unicleat, we might be given a certain set of instructions, and Jim has already developed a different plan, but just decided not to tell anybody. He'll wait till we take off and just tell us directly. So we end up having to change our course or change our routing, and it's really quite humorous at times. And if you allow it to become frustrating, it can be, but that's not the appropriate response.
No. I mean, it usually does work out better. Or if you knew all the facts, it would work out better.
If you know what he knows, then what he's doing is always the right thing. That's correct.
It seems like with the amount of freedom that you have also comes some personal responsibility. And it seems like a lot of pilots down here, you know, watch a show like this and have dreamed about being a bush pilot in Alaska. And how often do you get guys who come up there who realize once they're there that that kind of thing just isn't for them, and they actually like a different kind of flying?
Well, let me give you a summary statement before I begin, and that is that I believe that for every single type of pilot, there's a type of flying that matches that person perfectly. So everybody's good. Everybody is great at something. That being said, not everybody is great at flying in bush Alaska. And nobody knows that at first, or else nobody's going to volunteer for something they're not great at. I wouldn't believe. So the actual percentage of pilots is probably hard for me to identify, since there's multiple stages along the way before you're actually in the cockpit. I do know that from sitting on the hiring board for Hagelin Aviation, that particular event, from my observations only, appear to have about a 20% washout rate of candidates that want to get a job flying up here. And it seems like about 20% of them, the board identifies right off the bat that this probably is not in both people's, both parties' best interest. And so I guess I'll do the math as we go here. So now you've got 80% left over. they'll go into a ground school training, maybe in there, maybe another 10% will drop out. Let's just say maybe 20%. So now you're down to a 60% survival rate. Of that, probably 20% more drop out in flight training. So I guess we'll just say right off the bat that there's a 1/3 survival rate, meaning getting the position of total applicants. And that might be, I'm speaking off the top of my head here, so that might be a little bit harsh, but this is a very, very specific type of flying, and it takes a specific type of person to do it well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we've seen even once people get through all the training, the check rides, IOE, which is initial operating experience, and are officially on the line, sometimes in the first 6 months, it's just obvious it's not their thing, and it's usually their call. They're just like, this isn't, I just don't like this. I want more, I don't want to say more structure, but it's just not the type of flying they enjoy for whatever reason.
What you can identify is somebody, a particular individual becomes very frustrated, and they haven't realized it yet that this is just not for them, but they're frustrated because it's just not working out for them. And, and I don't know who, you know, sometimes the company identifies it first and lets them know that this is not for them, and sometimes the pilot identifies it first and realizes it's not for them. But that's not everybody. A lot of people love it, and they come out here, and they excel, and they do great. And if there's one quality that always does well, it's the happy-go-lucky person that you can never get down. If you have a good attitude, you'll do great.
A positive attitude.
It's all about attitude, because you don't know what you're doing yet, because this is such a different environment. We have to show you, and we will show you. That's our jobs. I'm an instructor. I'm a check airman. I'm on the hiring board. I've flown it here for a long time. Our jobs is to bring in people new and show them how to do it. And we work very hard in doing that. All we need is somebody else on the other end that's cooperating so the information can be transferred to them.
Yeah, and that also the passengers pick up on it, because you're flying the same people, and if they have a pilot who's happy and positive, that makes people feel better when they get in the plane with them.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. That's something that when I went up and flew around with Aiden for a couple of days, I don't even remember when that was. It was years ago. I was struck by how the distances between the bush and Anchorage and the distances between the villages in the bush and the towns is vast, and yet everybody knows everybody. And it's almost like all of Bush, Alaska has a small town feel, and yet there's hundreds of miles between each village. In some cases, I don't know. I was just struck by that, and I think the show is starting to convey that a little bit.
I can tell you that it is. My father-in-law, Vic Olson, he is 70 years old and still flies part-time for Hägglunds, and he is respected as the old-timer. He came out here in the 70s to Nome, and he's been flying ever since. And he got a phone call from a friend of his that saw the show, and for the last 20 years, Vic has been trying to describe to his friend how things work and how we need these runways out here and how the interaction is. And his friend called him up and said, I finally get it. I finally realized what you've been trying to tell me all these years. I couldn't figure out why the state of Alaska spends so much money on runways, and now I realize that's the only way that anybody can get around is through the air. There's no highway to drive. There's no roads. There's no rail between these bush remote villages that I fly to all the time. And so I think the show is doing a lot of things well, many of them I'm sure we haven't picked up on yet.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a lot of episodes to go, too. So we haven't seen a lot. But, yeah, I mean, the only way supplies get to the villages is by airplane, too. I mean, it's a pretty vital link. And it kind of brings up like after 9/11, when all aircraft were grounded for 3 days, there were issues out in Alaska with where villages are going to run out of food and hunters, where they're going to get picked up. And
I was one of them. That is correct.
Oh, you were one of the hunters. No, you were out hunting then. That makes sense.
Yeah, I was out hunting during 9/11, and I had three friends with me, and they were all from the lower 48 and hadn't been hunting in Alaska before. And one of them had commented how amazing it is that he can look up into the sky all day long and not see any airplanes at all. And what we didn't know was 9/11 had occurred and all the airplanes are grounded, but I sharply responded, very proud, that that's right, we are very remote out here and there's no airplanes. But the reality is, I guess the chances were pretty high they weren't going to be in the airplanes since the 9/11 attacks did occur. And our scheduled pickup was not for another week. However, there were 800 hunters that were trapped that could not travel back in because of that temporary grounding.
Wow.
That's quite a bit. How do you think, I kind of feel a little bit like since you and I both started early on there, we have pretty good access to kind of the upper ends of the company just because we know them from the older days. As a new pilot coming in, is there still the same kind of access to like Jim or the chief pilot, or is it just a little bit harder with more people? There's so many pilots at Hagelin now that, you know, how has that changed a bit, or do you feel like that has changed?
Yeah, I understand your question perfectly, and my answer to that is the access has not changed at all. Everyone has extremely open access. Now, I need to go on to say that the younger pilots simply haven't learned how to go about accessing that. I'm using the same word too many times, but a lot of newer pilots, they have questions for the chief pilot, questions for the assistant chief pilot, questions with the manager because everything's new for them. And so what ends up happening is a newer pilot consumes most of his time corresponding just trying to do what guys like you, Aiden, and me already do naturally. And so when I go to speak to someone of management or ownership, it's of a specific enough topic to where I'll get the answer right away. And a new person is just not asking the right question.
Right. Yep. And I imagine if a new pilot ends up in Nome, where you fly in Unicleed every day, they'd start getting that access a little bit more readily as well, just so they'd be seeing.
If a new person went up to anybody in management and asked the same question that I would ask, they'll get the same exact answer. There's no filter.
Right. Yep. And it's just they don't see the owners quite as much, I would imagine. But they could if they put themselves out there, is what it sounds like.
Exactly.
How has technology changed your experience? I know when you started, I don't even think the aircraft probably had GPSs in them, and then you guys had Capstone for a while. How has the technology changed what you do in terms of what you do, how you do it, the safety of it, but also just, you know, people think flying in Alaska is romantic, being a bush pilot is romantic. Has the technology changed that at all?
Yeah, well, the technology's changed a lot, and What the technology has done for us, it's made flying safer and made the pilot more dangerous. Now, that might be a little confusing, and so I'll explain this for a moment. You are correct. There was no GPS in aviation when I started flying, and there was Loran. However, the Loran was very limited because anytime the aircraft would be introduced to precipitation static, heavy rain or snow, the static would take out the Loran. So anytime you needed the navigation, it was not available to you at that point. And now we have GPS, and the GPS, we have moving maps, and now we have terrain avoidance systems, even in the smaller airplanes. And so it's made the entire experience safer because there's less actual situational awareness required from the pilot, and there's less experience required from the pilot to perform a similar job. So the flying is safer. Now, I said it made the pilot more dangerous because pilots are losing their skill set on how to actually look out the window and to use what nature provides to identify weather phenomena, wind direction, forecasting, all sorts of stuff, turbulence. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of visual and other cues available to the pilot that they're just not using because they're so used to just pushing a button and making it tell and having it tell them what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's I even see that as the tendency to think that the new guys are the ones who don't know it because they're coming up with the new technology. But even I remember talking to another guy that we've flown with out there quite a bit, and we were kind of laughing. I think the capstone wasn't working in a plane. We were like, man, this sucks. You know, what do I do without the capstone? A moving map. I don't have a moving map. And both of us had been out there, you know, way before any of that was prevalent or even used.
I've seen pilots try to ground flights because the GPS was not working, and this was a flight following the Kuskokwim River, and the pilot had indicated that didn't feel it was safe to go because the GPS wasn't working, and I was not sad. I didn't like that, but I wasn't his immediate supervisor, so my comment was, it's not like there's a river you can follow or anything such as that.
You mentioned you had the three airplanes you fly. Do you have a favorite out of your three, the Caravan, the 406, and the 1900?
Well, I do, and the reason I have a favorite is actually because of the mission the aircraft is dispatched on, not because of the physical properties of the airplane. The Caravan, the Cessna Caravan, is my favorite. And the reason why that is you may have already picked up on the fact that I enjoy the outdoors. And when I'm the captain of a Beech 1900, I'm at 20,000 feet, and I'm just not that in touch with the outdoor environment that I enjoy to live in. So when I'm in a Cessna Caravan, I'm not required to fly high to save fuel because the runs are typically shorter. So I'm flying down to the mountains, up the streams, and through the valleys, whichever one I choose. I might choose Valley A1 flight and Valley B the next flight, and neither one of them is frowned upon. It's my choice to make, and so because of the assignment, the Caravan is my most favorite airplane. It's also the easiest to get into when you start flying up here because our preliminary position for someone who has 250 hours or greater is the Caravan. We'll start the person off in the right-hand seat, and they'll get experience, and then we'll put them over into a 207. And within a year and a half, they're back in the Caravan as a captain.
Right, they mentioned that on the show about Jim's program. And I remember when they instituted this too. I thought it was really good. It's to primarily bring local kids up and give them a chance to get into flying with less experience. And bring them up, and they're more inclined to stay out there. And it seems like that program's worked pretty well. I think you've probably seen the same thing.
Well, now that show was almost misleading because anybody from anywhere can come up, and the local person gets an interview.
Right.
The person from out of state has to have his resume go through whatever type of filtering process they have, and sometimes too much experience can be a filter because the company enjoys the ability to show somebody, you know, their way of flying. So a lot of times somebody who has less experience is more valuable in the company's eyes. But once you get to the interview, there's no differential preferential treatment between a Laura 48 candidate or someone who's local.
Right. If I remember, they did implement that specifically to hopefully encourage locals. But you're right. The ones who started off were a bunch of people from Lower 48 got hired first in that program.
The reality is there's only one local pilot for every 10 out-of-state pilots,
right,
because of the lack of participation on the local level.
What advice would you have for somebody if they're a low-time pilot or not even a pilot yet, if they want to do this kind of flying? You know, there's a whole bunch of different ways to get flight training down here in the lower 48. You know, do you have a suggestion as to what path to take, or doesn't it matter?
Well, I don't think it really matters. Coming from the hiring board perspective, there are several ways to learn how to fly, and that can be touched on at a different point in time. And I'm not the best person for that since I'm just in one local environment up here, and there is no flight training going on in Bush, Alaska to speak of. But the best thing I could suggest for an individual is you have to be willing to bend. And I don't mean metal. What I mean is we're taught a certain way. This is the way we do things. And the reason we're taught that is because it's easier for a flight school or an instructor to just give the person one way to do something because they only have to learn it that one way. And then you get out to a remote site such as Bush, Alaska, and I imagine Africa or Antarctica or many other oddball spots in the world, you start to realize that maybe a different form of that right way to do something actually works better. So always be willing to learn something new is the advice that I guess I could give.
You mentioned that sometimes high-time resumes are not good, and I've heard that from other people who do the hiring in Alaska for other companies, and that ties in with just what you're saying. Do you find that if people have a lot of experience in a different flying environment, they have a hard time adapting to Alaskan style of flying?
A lot of them do, not everyone, and I think the reason why, someone of high time typically comes from a very structured environment such as an airline, regional airline, a 121, larger international or some type of airline. And in these airlines, it's a very, very structured form of flying. And I think what happens is an individual loses the skill set for quick decision making. And all we have out here is quick decision making. The outcome of something is 100% related to the pilot's decision making, not a dispatcher back behind a desk that is making a decision for you. We're out there away from radio range, and weather can just come in out of nowhere and just sock in all sorts of different places. And now the pilot's got to decide: do I stay down low and try to stay underneath this weather and land at a remote site that has no approach? Do I climb up high and try to shoot an approach to an airport that's very low, but at least they have facilities? And once you make either one of those two decisions, you're committed. And if you don't have the currency of that skill set, then I think it's very hard for you to make the transition back to it.
Yep, I would have to agree. And I continue on to that. I haven't flown up there in a while, and I've been doing other types of flying, and something I've discovered with flying is that you get really good at the type of flying you're doing. And it doesn't mean you can't learn what you used to know, but just that someone's high time doesn't mean they're going to be good at another type of flying. You have to be willing to relearn all over again if need be.
You're right. Experience is specific.
Yeah, that's what I moved into this ferry flying stuff. And I mean, a guy with 3,000 hours but a bunch of ferry flights is a better ferry pilot than I am. That's the nature
absolutely
of the beast. So, excellent. Well, I feel like we've touched on everything that I was interested in. Is there anything anyone else wants to throw in or comment on or talk about?
Yeah. No, I thought that was great.
Oh, good. Yeah, what I'd like to say is feel free to give me a call back at a future point. And if you have a different area you want to talk about, or if maybe somebody brings to some suggestions to you that they want to discuss, let's go ahead and open this conversation back up again in the future, and we'll talk some more.
Excellent. And I'll throw in there that I'll be up in Alaska in March to attend a Hagelin/Air Alaska ground school, or at least I'm planning on that. And I'm hoping to get out to Nome and visit with you a little bit more and maybe look at your life out of Nome a little bit more and see what's going on. And if we can think about it, expand upon this discussion, maybe more as it relates specifically to flying for Aero right now and how to go about getting a job. So
come on out. I'll take you out on a flight. Bring your camera, and we'll go flying.
Sounds great. Cool. All right.
Well, thanks, Doug.
Okay. All right, Mike. Yeah, sure. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com, oddballpilot.com, for more stuff like it.